Hi, and welcome to another episode of Terra Nullius Cyprus. I'm here in the Syrides Library of the CVAR Servetus Foundation in the old town of Nicosia. Thank you very much for hosting us. It's a beautiful venue. I advise everyone to come and visit this wonderful museum and gallery and check out the Syrides Library while you're here. I've got a guest today all the way from Australia. His name is Tim Slade. He's a producer, a writer, and a director. He's been screened in over 80 international film festivals, and he's been broadcasted in 50 countries. Not many people could even name 50 countries. Tim, welcome to Cyprus. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
You've also won the Best Film and Audience Festival Awards. Tell me, first of all, just quickly, where have you won Best Film? Where was that? What film was that for, and where was that?
One from memory was my film Four, which was a music documentary, which won Best Films, I think, in Honolulu and in Jakarta, from memory.
Wow. Four, as in the number four.
Yes.
And was that a music video documentary?
Yeah, it was. It used sort of the concept of the four seasons to base it. So we filmed it in four different countries in the season. So summer was in Australia.
Okay. Terrible time to be in Australia.
Terrible time, yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. And yeah. Jakarta, sorry, you won in Jakarta. It wasn't filmed in Jakarta.
No.
Okay. Jakarta would have been a complicated place to film otherwise. Yeah. And you won the gold plaque at the Chicago Hugo Television Awards.
Yes.
That's pretty fancy.
Yeah.
Is that like the equivalent of the Logie Awards in Chicago or?
Essentially.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Now, you're in Cyprus.
Yes.
Is this your first time here?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Hopefully not the last.
No.
When did you arrive?
Yesterday.
Okay. So you've not seen anything yet.
I've seen a little. I looked at part of the. I saw No Man's Land yesterday, and some of the old Venetian walls.
Okay.
So I got an initial sense.
A little crash course of old Nicosia and the Divide. Okay. Yes. So that would have probably been. Have you been anywhere else in the world where you've seen divisions like this? Or
no.
No. Okay.
Well, the only similar feeling perhaps is in Mostar in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good comparison. Yeah. Okay, there might not be a wall per se anymore, but that's actually a very good comparison. Mostar is what Nicosia would look like after the wall was removed, but with complications and conflicts remaining.
Yeah.
But welcome to one of the world's best frozen conflict zones. Super peaceful. You can have your cocktails right up against the green line. It's a very surreal place. Now, you're here on the island because you're screening your film, The Veto. Let me let you tell us a little about The Veto, what it is, because it's definitely not a music video documentary.
No.
It must be very different to the other jobs that you've done in the past. Tell us a little bit about it and why you've come to Cyprus to do it. I know that you're a guest of Bolidia. It's a group that looks into different political things and discussions and hosts panels and projects and whatnot. It's run by a good friend of mine, Anna Kukidou Prokopiou, who was actually a former Minister of Justice, and now she's the president of Bolidia. And that's how I've come to meet you, through her. So tell us a little bit about The Veto, which is being screened in Nicosia at the Levendis Gallery.
So The Veto is a film I'd wanted to make for some time. It looks at the veto power in the Security Council, which is a power that the five permanent members, Russia, China, the United States, the United Kingdom and France, were given in 1945.
The five victors of the World War
II. Yeah. And it was a prerequisite for them of actually joining the United Nations, that they would be able to veto any decisions made in the Security Council so that their national interests could be preserved. So essentially it was sort of discussed by Stalin and Roosevelt as being something that was necessary for them to have. So the film looks at that sort of strange little function in the UN and the immense power it gives those nations and the problems that it can trigger. And so in particular, the film looks at when the veto is used in situations which could be called illegal or in which genocide is happening or war crimes or crimes against humanity. And so the impetus to finally make it came initially in February 2022 when Ukraine was invaded.
Mm-hmm.
And people sort of, you know, in my circle would say, well, it's okay because obviously the United Nations will step in and they'll make Putin withdraw.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, no, they won't. and so the way that the veto was used to prevent the UN from meeting its primary function, the Security Council from meeting its primary function of keeping global peace and security, went out the window.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, when you have the P5, the permanent members of the UN Security Council, with a veto right. So if you have Russia invading Ukraine or Georgia or any other place they've invaded, it's very difficult for the world to push back when the invader has a veto power at the permanent Security Council. It's different when, for example, Turkey invades Cyprus or I can't think of another invasion. Okay, if you have a conflict in Sudan or whatever, you know, like sanctions and resolutions can come out very quickly or not. But if you have, for example, Israel-Palestine, you'll have the US always putting vetoes down. You have Russia putting vetoes down on their invasions. China will always put vetoes down when it comes to the South China Sea and Taiwan. France will put vetoes down when it comes to atomic testing in the Pacific. Australians will know that very well. I mean, I haven't seen the film, so I'm only hypothesizing the content of it now, but throwing out some ideas as well. What if, for example, the temporary members of the Security Council could perhaps override a veto? For example, if Russia puts down, I veto the sanction against us, or sorry, the UN resolution against the invasion of Ukraine, then maybe if the temporary seats majority votes against that veto, then it cancels out. That could help move things forward in international relations.
Definitely. Yeah. So that's one of, so the film looks in some level at some of the possible solutions around this. It doesn't do that in depth because mm-hmm. I believe that's up to the United Nations and the member states to do, mm-hmm. but certainly what you're describing is, and like the most recent veto, which was in June mm-hmm. on Gaza, again, on a ceasefire,
yeah.
exactly that thing happened. The elected members spent months, well, weeks, trying to create a resolution that the US wouldn't veto. And in the end they did, but it was 14 against one. And so that is exactly one of the possible approaches, that if there's 14, mm-hmm. they're all of the other members of the Security Council in opposition, then surely there can be some sort of mechanism.
Like an overriding mechanism. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or then you could even go to the General Assembly and perhaps have a weighted majority or whatever.
Right.
If even there there's a deadlock. There's so many opportunities to create deadlock. Yeah. I mean, World War II was now over 80 years ago. I mean, things have changed. The reality on the ground has changed. Yeah. I mean, this P5 is a much outdated system. I mean, okay, back after World War II, these five were somewhat friendly with each other. Within minutes, the Russia, Soviet Union versus the West collapsed that friendship. So it became outdated within days, let alone 80 years.
Right. And it's problematic in different ways now mm-hmm. with the new administration in the US, because there was not a veto used in, the veto is a problem. It will never be removed as such because it can be vetoed. The veto re-reviews can be vetoed. Yeah.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
It's interesting whether, for example, that France or the UK will be forced to use it again. Mm. They haven't since 1989. But I could imagine that could happen around Ukraine, for example.
The UK and France haven't used the veto since 1989. That's actually quite interesting.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So being the presumption being that if you use a veto, you're going to have a massive backup behind you to justify it. And so in this post-colonial world, France and the UK don't really have that.
Mm-hmm.
It comes with a lot of criticism if it's used, but of course the US, China and Russia are powerful enough still to be able to do that. But I could imagine if, say, Ukrainian territory or sovereignty was at risk, that potentially the UK or France may have to use it to protect that mm-hmm. because of what the implications could be for the rest of Europe. So
do you see a situation like that coming up anytime soon?
Not necessarily, but it's mm-hmm. possible. And so I thought of it in February when there was a resolution passed in which Russia and the US aligned on Ukraine, and it was mm-hmm. a very controversial resolution in which you know, the ways in which, say, for example, the US nitpicks over ensuring, say, that the way that Hamas is positioned in resolutions about Gaza must mm-hmm. happen. The way that Ukraine was positioned in this resolution was very concerning and yeah. and sort of essentially trying to advocate for a cessation of hostilities, which didn't sort of protect Ukrainian sovereignty or territory. And so it was a very controversial resolution, which the US and Russia both pushed forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so during that meeting, I was watching it live and I was thinking, wow, is this going to be where France or the UK has to actually veto it because of the implications for Europe? Yeah. They didn't in the end, they abstained, but I could imagine that both of those governments were considering having to use it.
Okay.
So in other words, yeah, that post the Cold War schism between Russia and the US helped keep a balance of power, but in a world where Russia and the US are more aligned, that's more threatening, I think.
Yeah. Well, it depends on what US as well. Like, is it Trump's US?
Or yeah,
is it,
yeah, right. Certainly the current. Yeah.
Yeah. What if the UN itself can't change because it's so locked in and these vetoes override everything? What's to stop BRICS and so forth, you know, turning around and going, okay, let's create our own system? I mean, I don't know if we'll ever see a day where, like, you know, India, Brazil, Japan, I don't know, give me 10 countries that are powerful, could turn around and go, yeah, we're leaving the UN, we're going to run our own show. I mean, what's to stop them from doing it? Why shouldn't they? I mean, it's a multipolar world now. It could be an alternative to the UN, and some countries may very well welcome that.
Yeah.
I can tell you now that I'm sure Ukraine and Georgia, for example, would welcome a non-UN
yep.
unit to defend them or help them right. in a way. Yeah.
yeah. I agree. Yeah. Which is why it's beholden on the UN to really make sure that it protects itself and doesn't use the excuse, which I do think it is a bit at the end of the day, that it's too difficult to change because of the bureaucratic system, because of the number of mechanisms that have to be gone through to make change. The threat is that it will become redundant, which serves nobody well. To the point of BRICS, I don't know what the reasons were for the Russian and Chinese leaders not attending this recent meeting, mm-hmm. which either has happened or is coming up, but that is not a good sign about BRICS yep. being a potential multilateral
context. And I'm sure China and Russia would not be keen for BRICS to replace the UN anytime soon because of what they have
at exactly.
the P5. Yeah. I know you've got countries like Cyprus, for example, which has relied for over half a century now, has relied on UN resolutions. But I wouldn't be the first Cypriot to tell you that most people see the UN without teeth.
Yeah.
Okay, yep, it's great. We've got bodies on the ground. We've got UN staff. I don't want to use the word soldiers. Well, I guess they're soldiers. Civil police and whatnot, roaming along the green line, keeping the peace per se. Are they? Well, the answer is probably no, because, I mean, if Turkey or the Greek Cypriots, if either were to attack each other, I can't see the UN stopping that. They can gather in a room and come out with a resolution and condemn something, but does that stop anything? No, it doesn't. The function of the UN, look, I mean, everyone is a member of the UN. Off the top of my head, I can't think who's not a UN member right now. But, I mean, what is the point of the UN if it does nothing other than, you know, create UN resolutions that are on paper, lovely to look at, but that's it.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's interesting. I'm not going to get this right because, but what I've been told by former ambassadors is the UN, the reason why states don't or can't leave the UN is because of an airline consistency regulation body that it controls. So it's sort of to fly globally, you have to be a member of the UN because of this.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what it is, but when I've raised it twice now, okay. that's come up as, well, they can't leave because of the air.
So basically, we stay in the US so we can continue flying.
Yeah.
Well, look, you certainly don't want to be the first country to leave the United Nations because that would be a...
But look, this is the thing. It has to function because we need that multilateral... forum. You know, or otherwise we'll end up with a world where smaller states like Cyprus or whatever it is have to go to Moscow or Beijing or Washington sort of cap in hand to get a deal done.
Well, look, this is the other thing, as in, like, I see small countries like Cyprus, you know, relying on the UN, but then Cyprus went and joined the European Union in a bid to get group security, to be part of a family, a club, a conglomerate, whatever you want to call it. The European Union is an example of a success story to a point. I mean, it has a lot of work to do, but compared to where we were 80 years ago, I mean, Europe was the site of the greatest massacres ever recorded in modern history. And yet today, the European Union is a body of peace, and the members of the European countries that are not members of Europe still have their collaborations. Okay, we had Brexit, but the UK is still friendly with the EU. And then you have like other entities that are trying to somewhat mimic the EU, like the African Union and like the Southeast Asian. I've just lost the acronym now, but you know, you've got these different groups trying to mimic somewhat what the EU is. This could be an alternative in some ways to the UN. Because I know that Cyprus, for example, sometimes doesn't focus on the UN resolutions and getting support from the UN, but then goes to Brussels and gets European Union support. And everyone waves their hands in there. But that's because the other party in Cyprus is Turkey. And Turkey is interested in what the European Union has to say about Cyprus. But let's just say that the north of Cyprus is occupied by Jakarta, then the European Union is not really going to have teeth on Jakarta, you know. But it does with Turkey. So this is an opportunity where Cyprus can have some teeth, some sanctions or some blockaging of accession talks for Turkey and whatnot. I mean, what does the Palestinian have? I mean, they don't have the EU. They don't, even the Islamic organization really doesn't have any executive power in that situation. So they are forced to rely on the UN, where the opposing party is backed by the US, who's always going to put a veto in. Having said that, coming back to Cyprus, Cyprus has utilized Russia's veto many, many times and has been thrilled to bits about it. But as Cyprus now shifts west and has become much more pro-Washington and whatnot, it remains to be seen what any future resolution of Cyprus is going to look like, when Russia may very well just say, you know what, I'm not going to veto for you anymore. You went against us in Ukraine, so here's our little punishment to you. You know, on the other hand, we, many of us would discuss the concept that Russia likes to keep the island divided, so we'll continually veto any peace plans. So,
And exactly. And so that's the core, I think, of, I suppose, what the end message of the film is, in a sense, which is the sort of consistent application of international law, I would say, really. In that, So that Cyprus doesn't have to rely on the whims of, say, Russia casting a veto or not, or whatever it may be. And to the point about Palestinians, so that, you know, and so I think there's some key tests for the UN coming up, one of which is Palestine and their actual membership, and whether in the face of threats of US withdrawal of funding completely, which I believe may or may not happen, could or could not happen outside of any position that the UN takes on Israel or Palestine, anyway, that they need to commit to full Palestinian membership and to...
Full Palestinian membership to the United Nations can't actually be vetoed by the P5, if I'm not mistaken. The General Assembly by majority can approve it, right?
No, Palestinian statehood formally at the UN is... been vetoed at least twice now by the US, last time in 2024.
So they still can veto even...
They say it's not ready yet for statehood. The US keeps saying that.
I can tell you a few other countries that may not be ready for statehood, but we won't go there. So I don't want to lose any listeners.
So I think that needs to happen. Like, and, you know, the 18th of September this year is when the occupied territories... meant to be vacated according to the International Court of Justice and according to a General Assembly resolution as well.
Now, when you say vacated, you're talking about up to the 1967 boundaries?
Exactly,
Okay.
And so what the UN does or doesn't do in response to the probability that they aren't vacated is a thing, which I think has massive implications for global security going into the future, and which is where... The general way that it works or doesn't work is really important outside of any sort of discussion about Israel and Palestine. You know,
well, look, if 18th of September comes and goes on the 19th of September, if
which will be during the UN high level week, too.
So. I mean, like, in all honesty, now, what can the UN actually do? Right. It can't go and pull people out with their hair.
It comes down to sanctions and how far are they willing to sanction Israel or willing to.
And then sanctions can be vetoed by the US.
The thing is, I think within the General Assembly, they could decide to impose certain sanctions. It seems to be at the moment, any sort of sanctions on Israel seem to be state by state. So Australia put some down the other day on certain Israeli individuals for example.
Yeah.
But I think...
I think there are sanctions... I think it's safe to say that sanctions don't really achieve what people think they achieve. I mean, Russia is still thriving. I mean, you speak to Russians that come out of Russia today, they're like, they've never had it better, some of them.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly. It has to be a serious collective sanction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and then you have other sanctions that only end up harming the people, like in Iran.
Right.
I mean, exactly. You have planes dropping out of the sky because they can't fix parts and whatnot.
Yeah.
I mean, sanctions really, they really need to be much better. They need to be more effective.
Yeah.
They need to be more targeted to where they're meant to be targeted.
Exactly.
Targeting individuals, yes, is one way because you're not affecting the gen pop, so to speak. Yeah. On the other hand, though, individuals find a way to shuffle money left, right, and center. We know that. Yeah. I mean, Cyprus was one of those places that was doing a great job of facilitating such actions.
The ideal situation is where international law is across the board and everyone... respects it.
Yeah. Or is it pick and choose and it's available or if it's for pick some?
And
I think we have certainly reached that discussion now globally with who does international law apply to?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you a couple questions about the actual film, the logistics of it, let's say. Was this something self-funded or is it funded by a body or?
It's funded by. Some of it was individual funding, generous individuals. Primary funding was from Open Society Foundations.
Okay.
Then some smaller foundations, the Foundation for Systemic Change, which is a small DC foundation, and the Jubitz Family Foundation, who have a remit about global peace and security. Okay. So it was, individuals and foundations... trusts who are focused on that.
Because I know that your industry is one that's very hard to get funding.
Yes.
It's very hard. I mean, making films is not cheap.
No.
I don't need to convince you of
this. And it's a very different landscape now. It's not, you know, working in Australia, I would have gone to the agencies there, but, you know, the joy of making films out of the US, at least up until now, has been that there's a lot of money there and that you'll find funders who are interested in any topic, however obscure it might be.
Yeah. Now, why have you come to Cyprus? Was it a random decision? Has somebody reached out, invited you? Like, I mean, Cyprus is not the kind of place that your average Australian would come across.
Yeah. So one of my funders, Cleopatra Kitty, is based here.
Yep.
And Politea, you know, sort of invited me to come and invited the film and obviously see the value of having this sort of film and discussion in a local context, in a Cypriot context.
No, and I know that you're going to have also Andreas Mavroyiannis, her former chief negotiator. He was the head of Cyprus's EU presidency in 2012. He's also going to be a discussant at your event at the Leventis Gallery. So these are some, good heavyweight Cypriots, Cleopatra Kitty as well.
Yeah.
Well-known, intelligent thinkers, doers.
Yeah.
And it's great that they've taken an interest in this guy from Australia who's made a film on something that is of interest to the Cypriots. I mean, the UN Security Council is something that Cypriots live and breathe daily in their news. I mean,
And as you said, you sort of indicated that Cyprus, and certainly Cleopatra said to me, Cyprus needs that consistency of international law because of its position, because of...
Look, Cyprus is both a benefactor and a victim of the UN, the need for UN reform.
Yes,
okay?
Yes.
And the current environment that Cyprus sits in the Middle East, with Iranian and Israeli rockets visible from the shores of Cyprus gives us an idea of how important this region is for peace and security, which can only come more sustainably from here on with UN reform, and it has to be a willing UN reform, and it does come with compromises. It will come at costs to some of the big guys. But overall, globally, it is going to be something that's going to be beneficial to all, yeah, including those that are going to have to relinquish some powers, per se.
Yeah.
Or they're going to have to face the music where another body eventually sets up against them. And that's when things get ugly.
Yeah. And exactly. Look, two things. At the end of the day, I think all of this, these imbalances long term, I don't think really serve Russia or China or the US. I know that's harder to argue at the moment, but I think it really doesn't. Partly because, as you said, they could just all, you know, fall apart and they won't have any usefulness for that power anyway. But also, yeah, at the end of the day, it's about human safety. And I was actually talking about Iran-Israel, shocked the other day. I have a nephew in Melbourne who's 19.
World's best place, sorry, just have to throw that in there. Yeah.
Who said to his mother how fearful he was of possible nuclear war.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a 19-year-old in Melbourne. You know,
which is basically where everyone's going to go for safety.
Yeah, if there is the first time he would have had to worry about possibility of nuclear war.
Yeah.
So these are the sort of implications of not sorting out these issues.
Yeah.
You know, let alone the fact that it's
they snowball and domino.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, from Australia. Australia is a relatively isolated, comfortable place where, you know, we are far away from everything. That's all well and good, but Australia is becoming more and more globalized and networked as we go along.
Yeah.
More and more people are coming and going from Australia. Yeah. There are more Australians now in the diaspora than ever before.
Yeah.
I mean, we never talked about an Australian diaspora until the last 10 years. And now there is an Australian diaspora. They are picking up the baggage and learning a lot about the world and bringing it back to Australia. I think Australia's foreign policy and its view of the world is still quite hazy and amateur, I'm sorry to say. I think that they don't fully have a grip on what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And that's, in a way, a blessing because they are living comfortably and don't have these physical conflicts. And I mean, okay, when was the last time Australia was attacked? World War II? I mean, and even that was not on the scale of what we're seeing elsewhere. So I think Australia is complacent.
Yeah.
They've gotten too comfortable.
Yeah.
And that will come to bite them in the future.
I think so too.
Yeah. I'm not saying that they should get into hard politics and start talking about defense and attacks and being offensive, whatever, but documentaries like yours will open up dialogues even in Australia. And, you know, I mean, I think
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because exactly. Australia is very reliant on two of the P3.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the US, the shifting relationship with the US is a very serious thing for Australia. And the potential of Chinese vetoes to do with sort of geopolitical things in Australia is a real.
China, Australia, this is actually, just to touch on this just very quickly, it's a very interesting relationship because it's Australia's biggest trading partner. I mean, you can't afford to have a conflict, a physical at least, conflict with China.
No.
But at the same time, it's kind of like your best friend and your worst enemy at the same time.
Exactly.
This is such a unique relationship.
Yeah.
And with so many Chinese people living in Australia, new and older migrants, and, you know, it's a relationship that it's a symbiosis, you know, that symbiotic relationship that really needs to survive.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not going to be good. And I dare say that it'll be worse for Australia being such a small populated country. Yeah. What are your future plans? Have you got another film in your mind, or is it too early to ask you? Is it like asking someone if they're planning on having another kid after they just give a birth?
No. I mean, the next film I think is going to be a narrative film, and it's going to be a comedy.
Okay.
Because it's like I really enjoy this work, this sort of work, and being able to interconnect with the diplomatic world and political world.
Oh, you definitely could make a comedy out of it.
But
diplomacy.
I'm like, I have to, I can't. It's
some of the best arguments can be fought through comedy. Some of the best lessons can be learned through comedy.
Absolutely.
I mean, stand-up comedians now have all become influencers politically, if you look at it now. Yeah. So the world has changed in that sense.
Yeah.
And I'm dead serious when I say that. I'm
like, no, totally.
Every stand-up comedian I'm watching lately is with a political message.
Yeah.
So if you do go ahead and make a film that's comic, I'm sure you're still going to find a way to weave a message in there.
Oh, yeah, totally.
That would be great. That would be great. Now, how long are you going to be in Cyprus for?
Only 3 days, unfortunately.
Okay, not enough time to really... You're going to scratch the surface, yeah. And I know that you're with good company, so yeah. you'll get a good taste of Cyprus. Get your halloumi dosage in while you're here. And where's next? Where are you... Because you mentioned just before we started recording that Athens was a destination.
So I think after this summer, there'll be screenings in Brussels, mm-hmm. Athens, London, hopefully Amman in Jordan, which will be good. So, yeah, I think some screenings in the Middle East
will
be important. And hopefully something around the UN High Level Week too in New York in September. So,
well, I wish you all the best with that. It's great to see Australia flying the flag around the world, but in an international forums like this. Thank you for visiting Cyprus. It's not often we get such a commendable people with great work coming through, so thank you. And I do look forward to seeing your next comedy film come through, and I am looking forward to watching The Veto.
There is one joke in The Veto.
Okay, yeah. don't ruin it. No, people have to watch it.
It's made by the Russian ambassador, and it's very funny. That's all I'll say.
Tim Slade, thank you so much for recording this podcast with me today. See you soon.
Thanks, Christopher.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.